This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Cinemas podcast. This week we will be discussing Stanley Tucci's biographical comedy drama, Final Portrait. I'm Sam Howlett and this week I'm joined by Jake Cunningham.
Hello.
And Ryan Hewitt.
Hello.
How are we?
We're well. We're
extraordinarily well.
Yeah. We're good. Excellent. Yeah.
What have you been up to this week?
Well, yesterday I watched 4 films in a row, which I probably can't talk about all of them yet, but I was in anticipation of The Square. Mm-hmm. For its premiere at Somerset House, I watched Force Majeure, which wow. I realised everyone in the room is a big fan of, and yeah. And really, with it being an artificial eye film, I probably should have seen by now, but I now watched it.
That's taken you quite a while to watch it.
It has, yeah. I don't know why it's taken me so long as well, but It's really good fun as well. It's excruciating.
Yeah.
But it's not in an excruciating way that I almost can't watch The Office anymore because I find it too much. It's a bit more acutely observed now, and there was just I love how he's got into the new mannerisms and language of how people interact with technology now. Mm-hmm. And how that, and I think that becomes a big part of The Square as well. Okay. And I think that there's a new realm of comedy of errors and interactions that we now have in relation to the internet, which he's one of maybe the few directors that's actually getting that into.
Okay. It's been compared to a kind of weird art house sort of Curb Your Enthusiasm scenario or a Seinfeld scenario.
Oh yeah. I could totally sit, and Jerry's on a date with someone.
You ran away. Of course, I ran away. You looking forward to the American remake, the inevitable American remake?
Oh, yeah, and it will be in Aspen or something.
Yeah. I remember. I don't know if this is still true, but it was going to be Julie Louis-Dreyfus.
Was it?
Yeah,
as the lead.
I don't know if she was going to be the lead or the wife role, but I mean, they're really going for that kind of feel.
And would Jerry Seinfeld be bumbling
in?
Yeah. And then I could only know his name, Tormund from Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
the beard guy. That's Larry David.
Yeah, Kramer.
Yeah.
Ryan, how about you? What have you been up to?
This week I've watched Greg Araki's The Doom Generation from '95, part 2 of his Teen Apocalypse trilogy, which pretty much says what it is. It is an extremely hip, completely nihilistic sort of road trip through some 3 characters' lives where they hook up and attack people for various reasons, and it's quite wild. It's not dissimilar to something like Natural Born Killers, but it's less politicized and it's a bit more about like youth culture. It's quite fun, but it's also extraordinarily problematic. One of those things about watching films from the 90s now is I realise that is over 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And a lot of the attitudes I've changed enormously since that. Yeah, it feels to me, it still feels kind of like a recent time because I was young growing up then. But some of the stuff that it comes out with is quite outrageous. But, you know, objectively speaking, it's a pretty fun ride.
Yeah.
Have you seen, the only Gregoraki film I've seen is the one with Joseph Gordon-Levitt? I think it's Mysterious Skin.
Oh, yeah.
I've only seen that one.
It's quite a different tone, although it's still very much going for shock value.
Yeah,
and it really goes there, like Doom Generation does, his other work does, The Living End and things like that. They really go there and really test boundaries. But Mysterious Skin is much more tender, I think, as well.
Interesting, okay. Mm. Well, I finally got around to watching Creep, the Mark Duplass film. It's phenomenally weird.
Didn't we watch another film called Creep? Is that the one on the train?
So there's another film called Creep, an English horror film from 2004, I think, which is about
set on the London Underground.
And it's
Sean Harris
is a weird mutant killer on the sub, on the underground. But this is a completely different film. This is essentially a found footage film. So there's two characters in it: Patrick Bryce, who directed the film as well, and Mark Duplass, and it's all improvised. And Mark Duplass hires Patrick Bryce to come to his house and document him for a day. And Mark Duplass is perhaps one of the creepiest characters of recent memory in this film. There's a fake wolf called Peach Fuzz that shows up from time to time. There's a thing called Tubby Time in the bar, which I don't want to go into.
Oh, I've seen the promo photo of him in the bar. That's horrible.
But I think it works really well because it's as funny as it is scary. So it's a perfect horror. It's not a horror comedy like Shaun of the Dead or Scream, where they're kind of, it's almost a pastiche of horror films. This is a horror comedy in that it's really, really funny, but also quite terrifying.
Right.
Well, that's a thing in the last few years in the realm of something like maybe You're Next.
Yeah, definitely.
Is it a mumblecore style film?
It's definitely got a lot of mumblecore stuff going on.
Right.
But it's so dark.
Yeah.
Like, shockingly dark at times in terms of dialogue and then in a certain thing that happens that I'm not surprised easily, I think, by films often, but this shocked me at times.
I have a friend who will tell me about a film that she's watched and she'll kind of start by telling you the synopsis and she will go through and talk for so long, but you don't know whether that where she is just the synopsis and it's like a big setup for the film or it's the whole film. I was like waiting for the synopsis of Creep to happen and then she was like, and then this thing happens and I was like, oh, and then that's going to be like the beginning of the film, and she was like, yeah, and that's how it ends. So now I know everything that happens in Creep.
To be fair, it's only 70 minutes long, so it's very easily to explain the synopsis to someone. But no, that's a really good watch, recommend that. Okay, so as mentioned earlier, we're talking about Stanley Tucci's Final Portrait, which tells the story of artist Alberto Giacometti, played by Geoffrey Rush, his attempts to paint a portrait of his friend and art critic James Lord, played by Armie Hammer. But Giacometti's obsessive perfectionism somewhat delays the process. Here's an exclusive clip.
Yeah, the end of the week, yeah.
Oh, I see.
I could change it again. I would like to know, you know, how many days do you need?
Oh, I don't know. I think it would be great to work for another week.
A week?
A week, yes. I think a week would be good.
No. A week is it's fine. It's fine. I can just move my flight next Wednesday. Would that...
Wednesday? Yes, Wednesday's good. Fine. Let's say Wednesday.
Okay. Good.
But then, you know...
What?
Well, I mean, there's no question of the portrait ever being finished, so...
No, of course.
So there is a Alberto Giacometti exhibition going on at the Tate Modern as we speak. How would you describe Giacometti's work, Ryan?
Wow. Well, I think it's very expressionistic.
Mm-hmm.
I know that he did dabble in surrealism and cubism and things like that, but it's definitely relatably human and very much about the internal soul of the people he's portraying, creating portraits of, be that sculptures or painted portraits. Yeah. So I feel like it's very expressionistic. I think it's really deep stuff.
Yeah.
And it's all very much there. You don't have to spend too much time looking at it to work out what kind of emotions are going on. Very, very and clear.
Really personal as well to him. Because when I walked into the exhibition, the first room is this big setup of loads of hits, loads of busts. And they're all of, they're of his wife, they're of his brother, his mother, his, so he's good friends with Simone de Beauvoir.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of her, and loads of the, most of the exhibition, most of the portraits and the busts and the figures are all based on these people in his life. And I think that's really interesting that this is then a film about him painting someone outside of that circle.
Yeah, that's true.
That's perhaps why it's a struggle, because he doesn't know
he's got to get to know the person.
So going into this film, I had certain expectations, I think, because, I mean, I know that Stanley Tucci is a very accomplished filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
Jeffrey Rush and Armie Hammer do very interesting roles, I think, these days. But I expected this to be quite safe, a bit quaint, a bit maybe terrestrial, but I was actually surprised that it wasn't just that.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's coming out at a time of year where we get films like Suffragette.
Yeah.
Where, okay, it's very, like, it's very friendly viewing. Mm. It's historical. It's informing. It's educating. It's entertaining.
Yeah.
but it's kind of just shy of any awards mark.
Yeah.
But it's almost there, and it's kind of building your way up to that season. And there's nothing wrong with that. And it's actually a really nice watch.
Yeah.
But that makes me sound like that's a bad thing.
Yeah.
That it doesn't have value. And it does. And I think what's key is there's a really good line at the start where Giacometti sits, James Lord, that's the giant, sits him down, and he says, "I'll never be able to paint you as I see you."
Right.
And I think that, for me, that coming so early into the film, that was Tucci kind of saying, "I'm never actually going to be able to make a film about how I see Giacometti."
Yeah.
So he's using this story of an outsider to just give a tiny little slice of life, really, rather than actually trying to penetrate what it means to be him.
Yeah, I think so. And I think these days the most successful biographies, if you can even call this film a biography, don't show the person, the subject, from birth to death anymore.
Yeah.
Because we're done with that.
Yeah, you pick a significant moment in their life, or like you say, something from an outsider's perspective that allows the audience who are also outsiders to get in.
Absolutely. Rather than try and penetrate, or rather than try and really work out what's going on in their mind, is a waste of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the most successful films to do that have been like Lincoln, been Selma, Steve Jobs, where it just showed you three short real-time moments of Steve Jobs' life rather than the Ashton Kutcher version, which goes through 50 years of his life or whatever. So this is really nice. I think set up, is it 18 days in the end of this film?
Yeah.
So 15 days in Paris in 1964, where James Lord goes to meet Giacometti, and he's been writing about Giacometti, and he's invited him there so he can paint a portrait of him. Very simple setup. And like I said, I knew this was the setup, and I was expecting it to be sort of light and funny, but I think there's more complex stuff going on than perhaps you would think, particularly in terms of the visual style. I was actually surprised at the camera, that the camera's handled.
I was going to bring this up, particularly with a film about a painter.
Yeah.
You often think it's got to be so composed. I'm thinking something like Mr. Turner,
where
every single shot feels like it's just been so precisely lined beforehand and storyboarded, and this feels quite fresh. And in a way, it's like when you see how Giacometti works with sculptures and stuff, and that he is quite frenetic in a way, and he's got for an old man, he's got a lot of energy as well.
Yeah.
And I think they're trying to, Jeffrey Rush is like that in the performance, and I think it's trying to match that with the form as well.
Yeah, the camera work's quite bumbling, isn't it? And Jeffrey Rush is pretty bumbling and almost drunken at times, but then the camera slightly softens and calms down a bit when they actually sit to paint.
Yeah.
And he calms or goes into the zone, and the camera goes with him.
Bumbling is a good word because the camera is often, it's moving in and out of buildings, it's close up, it's wide shot, it's all over the place. And yeah. I think that's perhaps Stanley Tucci thinking, you know, I'm making a film essentially about two people sitting down. How can I make this cinematic?
Yeah.
And I think he's done that really well.
Yeah.
And so as well as the camera, there's the sort of the sets and what Giacometti's workshop and house looks like. And they look like a Giacometti house would look. It's grey, it's messy. It looks like if you put your hand on the wall, something would come off with your hand
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
And that's what his, particularly the kind of, his famous figurines look like. They're kind of almost grotesque in a way, that they're kind of misshapen, long-limbed, really sort of lumpy and bumpy kind of texture yeah. to them.
Yeah, they look really emaciated and fragile yeah. and the studio is so chaotic
yeah.
that you're right, it feels like everywhere you turned, your coat jacket will just knock over a
yeah.
potentially priceless piece
but
of art.
I don't think he would even mind that
no.
if you
exactly.
did.
Yeah.
There's a really, one of my favourite scenes in the whole, in fact, I think my favourite scene in the whole thing is when he, Giacometti has a bag of money that he's got from
my
there.
My favourite scene as well.
Do you want to talk? Do you
no, go
all
for
right.
it.
He has this bag of money and he asks James Lord, Army Harry's character, to hide it on a high beam. And so James Lord climbs up onto this box and he's kind of reaching precariously over this statue, which is, I mean, we don't really know exactly what the statue is, but it's probably worth a lot.
Yeah.
And it kind of, and Tucci's teasing us, and in the like Jacques Tati version of this film, the box starts wobbling left to right and he falls and he smashes this thing, but that's not what this film is. And it's more about, it's less about what might happen and more about
yeah.
like Giacometti have seeming disregard for the safety of
his
all of his work
yeah.
and
yeah.
how he perceives the worth and value of it.
Yeah.
I thought it was such a great scene and such a great way to deal with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Notion of art and its worth, yeah.
I think that's a dilemma that kind of runs throughout, and you don't know whether Giacometti is genuinely kind of like defaming himself on purpose to seem humble, or whether that it is genuine. Because when there's a bit where he gets some old paintings back and he yeah. sells them new ones, and he treats it like he's just hustled them.
Yeah.
like he has so little value for these things.
These suckers have just paid me
yeah.
this money.
Yeah. But then he's got no, he doesn't seem to have any value for the money anyway.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting, like, the way that he treats, I suppose, his fame.
Yeah, and I mentioned in the introduction that he's this obsessive perfectionist, but I don't think that's quite the right word, because so it seems like he's getting really annoyed at himself, and he swears a lot while he's painting this portrait of James Lord, that he's obsessed with this painting, that he needs to make it perfect, that's why it's taking so long.
He's aggressively perfectionist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then he's more than happy to go out drinking and go out having coffee and long lunches. And it seems like he's using these things to distract himself from the painting and just needs an excuse to get away from the painting as well.
I think that's becomes part of his routine
right.
as well, that every painting has to have this frustrating process and everything has to be destroyed before it can be rebuilt. And this was what Brian Eno was doing with David
yeah.
Bowie, with his little, with the cards that I can't remember that he would bring into the
right.
studio and
right.
like get Bowie to pick out a card, and the card might say, destroy everything. It's like, well, it's what the card says, we've
yeah.
got to do it. And I think he's very much in just kind of waiting for something to happen
yeah.
and you're not quite sure. And that plays into the painting at the end as well, in that perhaps we don't know what is actually what process he's gone through to create the final portrait. And that doesn't quite matter. It's just really unpredictable what his methods actually are and what satisfies him in the end.
Yeah, and the so his brother Diego is played by Tony Shalhoub, and he says a couple of times, oh, this could, because James Lord asks him, how long will this take? And he says, I don't know, a couple of weeks, could be
yeah.
years, who am I to say?
Yeah.
So how did you think sort of art and the artist was represented in the film, about the process of making art and what the film's saying about art, if anything at all?
That's such
Jake,
a big
what's one. Art?
Does it have value? I struggle with films about artists a lot of the time, because I think ultimately you're using one a visual medium of storytelling to portray something else that is meant to be consumed in a different way as well. So it's like you're trying to represent a painting through a film, which is not how the painting is meant to be seen. And a lot of the time...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When someone is making a film about an artist, maybe not a painter, maybe it could be a musician, it could be whatever, a lot of the time they will try and make the form of the film reflective of the style of the artist. And like, I think
it's Mr. Turner, where like Mr. the Turner sky looks is, like it's been painted by Turner.
Exactly. And you've got stuff, sometimes it kind of works if it's done a bit more flippantly and a bit of a joke, maybe like miles ahead, like in that's in on the joke of being a jazz film, and it celebrates and disregards the idea of jazz at the same time, and I think that's fine. And then there's something like there's Basquiat the film, and then there's the documentary The Radiant Child, which I watched recently, and that is really aggressive and it's like all the sound levels are way all over the place with really frenetic jazz drumming and loads of different title cards in different typography and jumping around timelines and jumping between color, and you get that it's like, oh, we're trying to be a Basquiat but a film. But the thing is, you're not him. The thing that I like about him is his paintings, and actually I'd rather you just stuck to a normal form or a structure throughout, and you committed to a style and then showed the paintings and then gave information there, rather than trying to show someone's form in a different form who you are not. But I think this kind of gets away with it because it's not
trying,
it's not really aggressive as well.
You've got the other end of the spectrum as well, the Van Gogh film that's coming out soon.
Is it Loving Vincent?
Where the whole film is painted as a Van Gogh film. That's going to be a fun hour and a half or whatever.
Wait and see. That
to
one.
Me, yeah. That's got to be a Facebook, maybe 5 minute thing. That's got to be a migrated. Exactly.
Yeah.
When we all know that the best Van Gogh is the Doctor Who episode Vincent and the Doctor Richard Curtis.
I want to talk about Geoffrey Rush for a bit as well,
just in general.
I love Geoffrey Rush.
Yeah.
And at the exhibition they have there's a video at the end which shows him the real Giacometti painting,
the Arte documentary.
And my god, does Geoffrey Rush look exactly like Giacometti.
Really?
Yeah, it's the spitting image,
it's uncanny, isn't it? And it's all, so much of it is in the hair, I think.
Yeah, it's the hair. It's the sort of constant kind of scowl.
Yeah. It's,
and when he's painting, the sort of the way he moves his eyes and his hands are exactly identical.
It's that little flick of the eye, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And you see him, so as you see Giacometti painting a portrait, and the way his hands like flicks up and down and flicks back and forth is exactly the same as it's done in Final Portrait. So that's a nice little touch. And Geoffrey Rush as well is so is a complicated character, I think, Giacometti, because we've talked about how does he, is he in it for the money? Does he really love art? Is he really a perfectionist, etc.? And I think he gets that across. He gets everything he wants to across with actually not loads of dialogue, really. Mainly just noises and...
and one particular word repeated over and over again that we...
so I think he's...
cannot say.
Yeah, it's perfect casting and it's a great character to have at the centre of your film.
Mm. Weirdly, I was thinking of relatively recent Jeffrey Rush films.
Yeah.
Bar Pirates of the Caribbean, I went back to King's Speech.
Oh, yeah.
Where he is this, like...
Bertie.
Yeah, which is... yeah. 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 And, but he spends that film in a kind of regal, but also kind of decaying studio.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get out of my head that, that this is Bertie.
Yeah.
And it's like, things have gone wrong.
He's escaped to France.
Yeah.
Actually, France is really interesting in the film because you'd expect Paris in the 1960s to be heavily romanticised. And not, I know it's not quite the era of Midnight Paris, but I was expecting it to be a bit more of that kind of rose-tinted look of Paris. But Paris is really grey and not particularly appealing at all times in the film.
Yeah, we don't see a lot of Paris, do we?
We see little
streets and...
we see a graveyard.
Yeah.
I think the film... that's not a bad thing. The film does not have a high budget. And I think you can see that through its locations. And if you want to close down a Paris street for a day, that's going to cost you a lot. And it's not a coincidence that most of the stuff is happening in the studio and the street next to the studio.
Mm.
But I think as well, it works quite well for them that they maybe couldn't have the access to Paris that they might want, because it's showing that this is the reality of what Paris life is like for an artist, and that that kind of, that world, perhaps, as we think of it, doesn't really exist anymore in the mid-60s.
Yeah.
That this world where everyone in Paris was an artist or a writer or a poet, and you just hang around in coffee shops and it was all fine, that's not a reality anymore.
Mm.
Paris is actually more of a... is moving into something new that perhaps Giacometti won't be around for much longer there.
Yeah, actually that's a really good point, because there's a bit where he goes for lunch.
Yeah.
Which is a really great scene, I thought, where he goes to clearly his favourite place, and they've already got his lunch plated up.
Yeah.
They know exactly when he's going to finish his first glass of wine so they can bring out the second.
Yeah.
And then two espressos, and he consumes the whole thing within seconds. But they're the only ones in there.
Yeah.
It's
almost a sad scene.
Yeah.
And he kind of... the waiters are just hanging around, aren't they?
Mm.
Yeah, like they're expecting him, and they've got these two boiled eggs and slices of ham ready and waiting.
It's not particularly glamorous.
It's as though it's part of his routine, his creative process, isn't
it?
And he goes there and he has this set meal and they know it's coming, and Giacometti comes in every other day and he has the same thing. And
I think part of his identity that the film shows is that he's almost willing to let himself be exploited, and he's he's reached a point in his life where he knows he's got money and he doesn't really value it, and so he doesn't quite care when people want it.
Yeah.
And so when he pays for the lunch, he just throws a load of cash on the table.
Yeah, may or may not be the actual price.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just like, fine, we'll have that.
And the same way that there's a scene involving the pimps of the prostitute who's his muse, and he just keeps raising the price that he wants to pay.
And they've said, no, that's too much. That was an interesting character I didn't know about. The prostitute who's his muse.
The Clemence Posey.
Yeah.
Who's quite annoying, but intentionally so.
Yeah, she's in this like kind of laissez-faire life where she comes and goes. What did you make of the way that those relationships were shot? Because... if I'm not mistaken, every time that he was with her, his wife observed through a distorted pane of glass or in a reflection, and you never saw...
they weren't in the same scene.
Yeah, there was always some kind of distortion that they viewed them from. But everyone stuck around for it.
Yeah.
Nobody...
I think it's a really interesting dynamic that's created between him and the muse, because then it's Annette is his wife, and that's Sylvie Testud, who's really good. Like
she's
in this, she's brilliant, and because she takes her own lover as well,
yeah.
doesn't she? Who again we see through a window pane.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's you do get this distortion of what these relationships actually are, because then there is another scene after we've maybe seen what in any other film would be the thing that crumbles the marriage. Whereas in this, in the next scene, they seem the happiest that we've seen
them.
Yeah,
they're laying down together, they're talking about they're going to the opera, and they're happy.
And I think that's maybe, it suggests that that has always been the dynamic.
Yeah, I think so. And what you got from the exhibition was that he did really love, and that and he painted her all
absolutely,
the time.
Absolutely, yeah. It is strange. It's almost as though he, you know, once you achieve a certain level of success, the natural torment of life kind of evaporates. Yeah. But he and his wife seem to try and manufacture strife and issues to keep that, whatever that is, if that's the source of the creative juice.
Yeah, that's part of it. It's almost like she knows that she needs to provoke him to get him to work.
Yeah, maybe. And what did you think of Armie Hammer as kind of the audience in corporate? So he's out eyes and ears on the scene, effectively.
Yeah.
Everything seen through here, his facial expressions, like, what is going on? This is crazy. Like you say, looking through windows and slowly uncovering what life is like for the Giacometti family.
But it's not like it's like Van Wilder or something, where he's stumbled into a crazy artist studio and is going like, what's going on here?
Looks at the camera like...
He's actually... like, this could be really over-the-top performance from him.
Yeah.
But I think he handles it really nicely. And it's in the similar stuff to what he did with Man from U.N.C.L.E. in the comedy, and that is quite... like, it's all in the eyes and in the looks. And he looks... really good in this as well.
Yeah,
just sitting there, and I think like as a deal for him on the hammock, it's like you just come here. It's like one maybe two locations, and you just get to sit down.
Yeah,
do you have any lines? Yeah, maybe it's like here and there.
Yeah,
I always like when Giacometti calls him. You have the head of a brute.
Yeah,
thanks.
Yeah,
it's the continuation of the Hammersance. Are we calling it?
Armie Hammersance. Did he have a bad run?
He didn't really have a bad run, but he just kind of was sporadically in a couple of things for a while, and then just I feel like the past year.
Oh yeah, was it at LFF? Yeah. He was in about four.
He was
things.
In four or five films at LFF. He's going to be so he's in this. He's in the next Ben Wheatley film. He's in
Call Me By Your Name,
which
he was in Free Fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he's in.
Was he in Nocturnal Animals?
He was in So I saw in one day, I saw Birth of a Nation, which he's in, Free Fire, and Nocturnal Animals, all of which Armie Hammer has some kind of supporting role in.
Wow.
Yeah. Who is his agent?
Yeah.
Give that person a raise. I think he's really becoming someone quite recognised, but quite worth watching. He's really someone to come out for, I mean.
Yeah.
I'm glad that he didn't get that Superman role that he was meant to have. Was it Batman?
Yeah, it was Batman.
That for George Miller's
Justice League. Yeah.
Right.
But he was like 20 years old, which wouldn't have worked.
Yeah. And that was pre-Social Network. And who knew of Armie Hammer at that point?
Yeah.
That was the thing.
It also took me ages to realise his name was Armie and not Arnie. Arnold Hammer, surely.
That would be a great name.
It's Armand.
Armand Hammer.
That's so good.
Imagine growing up with that name and not being cool. Like your parents were just like, well, we've got to risk it. He's just got to be cool.
We tried. Yeah.
Actually, something about... we mentioned the camera earlier.
Yes.
The way that he shoots... he shoots Armie Hammer when it's coming from Giacometti's perspective, really close up and with a really shallow depth of field that kind of moves between the background and foreground. And when you look at the painting that he's working on, the background of the painting and his clothes are really not the focus at all. Mm. It's all the face. And that's, he'll do a bit of the face, won't like it, paint over it, do the face again.
Yeah.
And this becomes something that Hammer tries to actually get in the way of as well, to stop him just painting over and over. And I think that is in the camera work of how we see James Lord in the chair, in that it's always around the face, yeah. And it's pulling from the background in, but it's never a full facial close-up. It will move from the chin up to the eyes, or it will pull focus from the background to his ear. And I think this is trying to reflect the way that Giacometti's looking at him and looking at what he's actually interested in. And it's like he will just be looking at an ear, and he might just be spending an hour thinking about how to do the ear.
Yeah, absolutely. Any final thoughts then on the final portrait?
I think it ends on a really nice note.
Yeah, yeah.
When we're not worried about spoilers here, are we? I mean, it's...
We know that the portrait is painted.
It gets painted, yeah. And yeah. It ends, doesn't it? It could never end. But Armie Hammer and James Lord have to kind of interject and make it end.
Yeah.
Well, because he needs to fly back to New York.
Yeah.
He needs. Kind of yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. You've done it. That's good.
Yeah.
What is it? It's something.
Yeah. He says.
It's progress.
We've got far. We could have gone further. But we've got somewhere, and that's something.
Yeah.
Something to that effect.
But he says really that he never considers any of the pictures finished.
Oh yeah, he says. It's impossible to finish a portrait.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think this, when we look at it, but when you look at his other paintings as well, they could be unfinished.
Yeah.
But that is completely part of it.
Yeah. And you see him working on a sculpture. He does two things to it and then leaves it. And you get the feeling that these sculptures have been in his room for years, that every now and then he'll tinker with it a bit and I think, I'll go back to it at some point.
Yeah.
Yes, they could never be finished. Yeah, that's a really nice way to end it. And they end in a graveyard where... he kind of says, oh, I would walk you to the airport, but I'm not going to. Essentially.
And he really doesn't linger on the film.
No.
Like, Tucci, to his credit, he knows where the story ends.
Yeah.
And so it ends there. It doesn't have title cards like, Giacometti would go on to be recognised. James Lord's article would be published.
Yeah.
And Armie Hammer does have some voiceover narration.
Yeah.
Which... maybe
I knew she was a replicant.
But it doesn't end like that. As I saw Giacometti walking away, it changed my life forever. So that's the final portrait. That's out today. Do check it out. And the Giacometti exhibition is on at the Tate Modern until the 10th of September.
Then I think it gets taken over by Basquiat.
Oh, perfect. Oh. There we go. It's all connected.
It is.
Cousin Home Cinema, what could you watch on there this week, Jake?
Yeah, so if you're wanting to pair Final Portrait with something, I think Finding Vivian Maier is a really interesting documentary that touches on some of the points that I was making earlier about directors trying to outdo their subjects. And I would strongly recommend watching this film to get an insight into Vivian Maier, this photographer who was absolutely amazing and never shared any of her photos with anyone. And so completely privately kept all the negatives, everything, and then she died. And then this director, John Maloof, was at an auction and just bought the negatives on the chance that there might be something in there. Looks at them, and suddenly we've found one of the best American street photographers of the 20th century, which is such a good story. And seeing the photos on a whatever screen you can, you'll be completely stunned by them. And that is why you should watch the film, as an access point for Maya. And then just look at the images, go out and buy the photo book, and just to tell her story, because it is tragic. And there's an investigation into who she was and what her job was and what her family background is. But it's just that there are points in the film where it's like Maloof is trying to be the director and let you know, I am here. Like, I'm also making something here. It's not about these images, because I am the director here. But I would really recommend watching it anyway, just to get into those photos, because her photography is absolutely amazing.
Yeah. I'd also recommend Hitchcock Truffaut, a documentary about the meeting between and the conversations between Alfred Hitchcock and Francois Truffaut. They don't have exactly the same dynamic as Giacometti and Lord, but there's something there about this kind of interviewing this great artist and exploring his work through the medium of film. And if you're a Hitchcock fan, I think this is a must see. And you've also got interviews with people like Martin Scorsese, who shed light on what Hitchcock means to them. So check that out. Great. So that is goodbye from Jake.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from Ryan.
Goodbye.
And goodbye from me. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.